WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. Mary Baldwin's president resigns just over 4 months after taking the job. Drought in our area deepens, and it's worst in the Shenandoah Valley. Also, what might the new General Assembly session mean for gun violence intervention in Virginia? This is the WMRA Daily for Friday, January 16th. Mary Baldwin University announced Thursday that its president, Todd Telemico, has resigned. WHSV reports that Telemico will step down from his position at the end of June, citing personal and family reasons. He took the position shortly after the start of the academic year, when former President Jeff Stein unexpectedly resigned. Since then, MBU has faced several controversies, including votes of no confidence in the university's board of trustees from both faculty and alumni, and cuts to liberal arts programs that sparked student protests in November. In the same announcement as Telemico's resignation, MBU announced that four academic minors that had been discontinued would be reinstated, but did not specify which programs. Harrisonburg's city council is expressing its concern to federal and state leaders over federal immigration law enforcement actions in the city. The Harrisonburg Citizen reports that council sent a letter expressing concerns from city residents about conduct during detention stops by federal immigration agents. The council members also sought clarification on where the public could report concerns about conduct and asked about policies governing the use of force. City Council sent the letter to members of Congress representing our area and the incoming administration of Governor-elect Abigail Spanberger. As President Trump expands immigration enforcement around the country, Virginia legislators are looking to rein in some of those activities. Virginia Public Radio's Brad Cutner reports.
I think that we are in the middle of a battle across the country, likely to get worse before it gets better.
That's Roanoke Democratic delegate Sam Rasul on what he expects from President Donald Trump's immigration enforcement in the Commonwealth. Though ICE and its fallout are already here. Ryan Durazzo is an immigration attorney with the immigration assistance group AUDA. He works with children and those who've survived human trafficking and domestic violence. One of his clients, a school-aged boy from Fredericksburg who has protected status, committed an infraction at school and, Durazzo said, his school resource officer called ICE.
Within a matter of hours, they came to his foster home, put him in handcuffs, and transported him across state lines to where he couldn't be reached.
Legislation is expected to address ICE's cooperation with school resource officers, and in the wake of ICE nabbing folks from courthouses like at Chesterfield, Fairfax County Democratic Senator Saddam Saleem wants to empower local courts to limit ICE ability to make such arrests.
No one goes into the courthouse if they're criminals unless they're already handcuffed. There should be protections for anyone that goes into the court system and comes out without that fear of ICE lurking in the background.
As for the Republican interest in the issue, Hanover Senate Minority Leader Ryan McDougall called immigration a distraction. Specific legislation is still being worked out. The deadline for any new immigration law proposals is next week. In Richmond, I'm Brad Cutner.
Drought continues in our area. The Virginia Department of Environmental Quality, DEQ, has issued a drought warning for much of the Shenandoah Valley from Augusta County to Northern Virginia. The city of Stanton said that the advisory is intended to increase awareness that a significant drought event is imminent in much of the Shenandoah Valley. DEQ lists areas east of the Blue Ridge Mountains under a drought watch. In response, the town of Timberville has issued voluntary water use restrictions for residents. Earlier this month, the town of Woodstock also issued restrictions. The ombudsman who monitors the Virginia Corrections Department completed two investigations into a pair of prisons during fiscal year 2025. Virginia Public Radio's Dave Cantor takes a look.
One investigation focused on complaints made by men held at Red Onion State Prison. Allegations around racism, rights violations, and retaliatory behavior by Department of Corrections staff were deemed to be inconclusive. That means there wasn't ample evidence to support or disprove the claims. Others, ranging from medical neglect and extended solitary confinement to individuals being served unsanitary food and physical and sexual abuse, were unsubstantiated, according to the report, though the investigation said at least some problematic behavior was identified. Tlaib Peak served two stints at Red Onion and identified a range of other issues, including that staff manipulated his access to food.
They should be talking about actual deaths, actual beatings. Like, racism, I think, is kind of built into the fabric of Red Onion and Wallace Ridge.
VDOC didn't respond to a request for comment. Will Palfrey is a criminal justice professor at Virginia Commonwealth University.
Clearly, there is something at Red Onion that demands further review, if not by the OIG or DOC, then some other element within the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Another investigation into a pair of complaints at the Greensville Correctional Center resulted in the only substantiated finding across the two facilities. A court order required an individual to receive a certain number of, quote, snack bags per day, though the investigation determined VDOC staff hadn't fulfilled its obligation on two occasions during a two-year period. I'm Dave Cantor.
Several state lawmakers plan to take key roles in Governor-elect Abigail Spanberger's administration, but what will happen to their pending legislation that they sponsored? Dean Mirshahi with VPM News reports.
There aren't rules on what happens to a General Assembly bill when the lawmaker who carried it leaves office before or during a legislative session. Instead, its future relies mostly on legislators finding a colleague to keep it going. The incoming governor has tapped three Democratic delegates to serve in her cabinet. Abigail Spanberger also named State Senator Adam Eben to be a senior advisor at the Cannabis Control Authority. The Alexandria Democrat is leaving his Senate seat in February, after the 2026 session's halfway point.
I'll probably get senators who I designate as chief co-patrons or maybe even a delegate to present the bills after they go over there.
A bill to ban ghost guns is among the ones Eben says he will have to pass off to another lawmaker. Spanberger's inauguration takes place Saturday in Richmond.
Dean Mirshahi reporting. The General Assembly is back in session this week. As we've been reporting, members are debating the merits of affordability. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope has more.
It's the hottest topic in politics, affordability. Democrats who control the House and Senate have what they call an affordability agenda. Everything from raising the minimum wage and lowering prescription drug prices to access to contraception and paid family and medical leave. Senate Minority Leader Ryan McDougal says Democrats aren't really focused on affordability.
Our friends on the other side, Virginia Democrats, have promised affordability throughout the election cycle. But on day one, instead of focusing on affordability, instead of focusing on Virginians having more money in their wallets and purses, our Democratic friends focused on gerrymandering and trying to change congressional districts to disenfranchise Republicans.
Senate Majority Leader Scott Surville says Democrats will be pursuing their affordability agenda while also digging Virginia out of the hole created by outgoing Governor Glenn Youngkin.
We have a $3.2 billion Medicaid shortfall because of this governor can't forecast Medicaid. We had to find $900 million to fund K-12 just to level set things when we come back. And we're gonna be actually picking up the pieces for the next 60 days here, trying to put things back together.
Youngkin will cease to be governor on Saturday when Abigail Spanberger will be inaugurated as Virginia's 75th governor. Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, I'm Michael Pope.
Well, it is a time of transition at the state capitol. Politics analyst Jeff Shapiro joins Michael to recap the week in politics and state government.
The General Assembly is back in session, so we're coming to you from the grand lobby of the Virginia General Assembly building. And Jeff Shapiro, outgoing Governor Glenn Youngkin, kicked off the General Assembly's session with a primetime speech to lawmakers. What did Youngkin have to say?
Not surprising, it was a valedictory. He had lots of great things to say about his administration. I think what's really significant about the speech is what he didn't say. He didn't talk a lot about Donald Trump. There was one direct reference to Donald Trump, a couple of indirect references, a warning to the legislature that it needs to work with the Republican administration in Washington. Of course, barely an acknowledgement by the governor that it was pushback to Trump that contributed to the repudiation of his candidate for governor and that big Democratic sweep led by Abigail Spanberger. And the icing on the cake, of course, for the Democrats, a 13-seat pickup in the General Assembly. Big point emphasized by Youngkin that brought Republicans to their feet. that Democrats should not even consider or discuss the possibility of doing away with Virginia's right to work law. Of course, it bans union membership as a condition for employment. There are any number of Democrats who would like to do that. Governor-elect Abigail Spanberger, who ran as a centrist, continues to posture and position herself as a centrist, has said she would veto such legislation.
So the Democrats didn't waste any time with the constitutional amendments they want to pass, right out of the gate passing constitutional amendments to protect abortion rights and voting rights and gay rights, and then also redistricting. What is the debate over these amendments going to look like?
This is a reminder that with the numbers the Democrats have, all of this is going to be fast-tracked, in particular those constitutional tweaks necessary to achieve mid-decade redistricting, or as I'm fond of calling it, redistricting. All of this in response to what the Republicans are doing nationally in an attempt to protect the Republican majority, that very narrow Republican majority in the House of Representatives. The Democrats are looking at creating up to four new Democrat-friendly seats. That would be up from currently six, and that would give Democrats a 10-1 advantage in the House delegation, and gosh knows, presumably would help the Democrats in Washington.
So this weekend, Virginia will be saying goodbye to the 74th governor, Glenn Youngkin, and inaugurating a new governor, the 75th governor of Virginia. Jeff Shapiro, what can we expect from the inauguration on Saturday?
And not just any 75th governor. Abigail Davis Spanberger is the first woman to be installed as chief executive of Virginia. She ran as a centrist. She has conducted herself through the transition as a centrist, certainly hopes to be perceived as such. And one can, I think, safely assume that that's the tone she is going to strike in her inaugural address on Saturday and her policy remarks to the legislature on Monday. One of the big themes, of course, for the Democrats in Virginia and nationally, affordability, doing something about ever-escalating prices, the inflation crisis, if you will.
All right, that's all the time that we've got for now. My name is Michael Pope, and we have been joined by politics analyst and UVA scholar Jeff Shapiro. Talk to you after the inauguration.
Looking forward to it.
Several bills related to firearm safety are among the many issues that would be considered in the House of Delegates and State Senate. Joshua Horowitz is a professor in the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. WMRA's Calvin Penn asked him what this General Assembly session could mean for gun violence intervention in the Commonwealth.
Well, so I think there's a couple of things going on. Number one, there's been way too much gun violence in Virginia. So in 2024, we saw almost 1,200 Virginians die by gun violence, and that's one person every 8 hours. So we have a continuing crisis in gun violence in Virginia. We need to do a better job. The current the new legislature coming in with supporters of gun violence prevention in the House of Delegates and in the Senate, and of course a champion in the governor's mansion, we have a unique opportunity to pass new gun laws. The prior administration really let the policy side of this slip and didn't push anything. In fact, vetoed all sorts of life-saving bills. So we think there's an opportunity to pass a strong group of gun violence prevention laws this year and start to make better progress in reducing gun violence in Virginia. So it's unique because we have a brand new House of Delegates and Senate and governor who are much more supportive of gun violence prevention than in the past. So we're looking at things to pass. We want to continue to improve the state's red flag law. We want to improve our safe storage requirements for firearms. And most importantly, we want a robust firearm purchaser licensing bill that other states have enacted with great success. And I think that we can do that. And firearm purchaser licensing is something that's popular in Virginia. It saves lives. Other states have done it, saves lives. And I think we need to do it here in Virginia.
I want to go back real quick to the red flag law. What steps can be taken to improve the implementation of that?
It's a powerful law right now. We've had it since 2020, and we see that it's saving lives across the Commonwealth. Right now, It's limited to law enforcement. And so a red flag law, for people who don't know, it's a civil protection order, a temporary civil protection order that allows law enforcement to go to a judge. It's all with judicial oversight, and have a firearm removed from someone who's in crisis to themselves or others for up to 6 months. And we're seeing it being used in many locations in Virginia. It mirrors laws in 21 other states. But most of those other laws allow family members to also petition a judge. And we think in Virginia that needs to be done. And so we want to add the ability of family members to petition a judge for firearm removal law. And it's important because sometimes you just don't have time to, you know, tell all the facts to law enforcement, work through the bureaucracy a little bit. Here, family members can go to court immediately when a loved one is in crisis.
I'd say they all kind of tie back to, you know, a public health approach. I'd love to know more about how addressing gun safety legislation that way could possibly make a difference this time around.
Yeah, well, thanks for asking about a public health approach. I
of course,
school of public health, right? So that makes sense that we'd want to look at public health. But people throw that term around a lot, and I just want to give for the listeners just a quick piece about public health, which is, you know, first you have to collect data. We talk so much about policy without thinking of, I mean, people do. Oh, we need to do this. We need to do that. We need to collect data. Right. That's like number one. And so public health is based on data. And at our center, we produce our own work. We look at our own research. It's always nonpartisan. Right. It's always we're looking at it's objective and nonpartisan research. So that's the basis of public health. And then you want to start thinking about looking at that data, where the problem is. Who's being injured? What are the types of interventions that might work? And then you test those interventions. And if they work, you want widespread adoption. There's a methodology to that. And so the laws that we're talking about, especially the laws I'm talking about today, including firearm purchase or licensing, these things have been developed through the public health approach, by collecting data, by understanding where the harm is causing, by designing interventions that can help with reduce that harm, and then rolling them out. What we know now is that we have a lot of data about this. We've seen other states develop these types of laws. We collected data about that. In fact, when you look at Connecticut, they enacted firearm purchaser licensing, and their gun death, both homicide and suicide, went down by approximately 30%. Missouri, when they got rid of their firearm purchaser licensing law, their homicide went up 30% and their suicide went up 15%. So when you think about the public health process, you identify the problem, you study it, you design the intervention. This is the intervention that saves lives, firearm purchaser licensing, and it's all based on the public health model.
Well, Joshua, thank you so much. This has been very informative, and we will be following all the legislation as it's going through this session. And thank you so much.
Yeah, and if you want more information about us, you can Google us at the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions.
You can listen to the full interview with Joshua Horowitz at WMRA.org and on our app. Finally today, a new study from Christopher Newport University says flock cameras in Hampton Roads are concentrated in black communities, WHRO's Toby Cox reports.
Automatic license plate reader cameras take pictures of vehicles, including make, model, and bumper stickers. They save the information in searchable databases used by law enforcement, raising privacy and legal concerns. Last fall, a federal judge unsealed the location of more than 600 of these cameras installed around Hampton Roads by a company called Flock. CNU professor Johnny Finn mapped them. He found that Flock cameras in the region were highly concentrated in majority black neighborhoods in high poverty areas.
Of the 10 census tracts in Hampton Roads with the most cameras, 8 of those 10 are majority black.
Flock has said the data their cameras collect is objective. Finn says the data can't be objective if surveillance technology continues historical patterns of over-policing.
Toby Cox reporting. The cities of Charlottesville and Stanton have ended their contracts with Flock Safety. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy your Friday.